The Buddha, 2,500 years ago before modern neuroscience, 2,400 years ago before Freud and Jung, managed an amazing insight which rivals that of Galileo and Copernicus's revelation that, in fact, the sun does not revolve around the earth despite its appearances. One of the great, great insights that man has accomplished was the result of the, just like Galileo and Copernicus came upon the revelation by keen observation and then reflection, the Buddha, 2,500 years ago, through keen observation and reflection alone, without access to any MRI scans or any of the clinical studies of modern science, came upon the realization through his practice that the despite what we think, what's going on inside of our minds is not the result of a little thinker in there that's creating our thoughts, creating our ideas, and is relatively consistent. We experience what's going on inside of our minds as if we have this rather consistent. We have our off days and on days, but we experience what's going on as this somewhat reliable, consistent, underlying little internal, you know, the Wizard of Oz in there behind the curtains or whatever, the little person behind the eyeballs, the thinker in our brains. We think there's a little me in there somewhere. And sure, I have these weird ideas and urges that don't feel, and addictions that don't feel like they're really coming from my thinker, but I have that thing that's me inside of there. And this is just as much an illusion as the idea of the sun revolving around the earth. Now, to explain it, I'm going to take just a few moments to tell you what's actually going on from a scientific perspective. So then when I tell you the Buddha's observations and why it's important, it'll be a little clearer. What we know now from a lot of fMRI and wonderful, wonderful research by neuroscientists as far-ranging as Eric Kandel, Joseph Ledoux, Antonio Damasio, you name it, is that the human mind, as we experience it, is actually the result of urges, impulses, ideas coming from very, very many different subsystems in the brain. There is no single subsystem that is always firing. Despite your experience of your mind having a center or a core or a thinker, there is no part of the brain that's always turned on and thinking. In fact, when you look at any of the urges or ideas or anything that occurs in our lives, what's really going on is we've got, starting off, we get contact with the senses. It goes through the thalamus, and then all these very old regions of the brain, the amygdalus and the hypothalamus and the hippocampus and etc., the nucleus accumbens, they grab onto these quickly, before, well before we're conscious, and they come up with urges. And then after that, we have relatively newer regions like the striatum, which records our habitually ingrained actions, and then they throw ideas up. And then all these urges and impulses are thrown towards an area of the brain called the cingulate. And the cingulate then passes it on to the higher regions, which weigh, and there's way which things we should do. And there's many different parts of the frontal region. There's things like the ventral media and the dorsal lateral and the orbital frontal. And these are all members of the committee in your mind. And they are weighing and arguing, this is even before you're conscious of it, what to do. It's happening every moment. If I asked you, what would you rather have, a slice of pizza or a milkshake? Maybe you say, well, why can't I have both? But immediately the hypothalamus is checking in with your blood sugar levels, and the amygdala is wondering, has it ever had a bad experience with a milkshake? And then the insula, which is part of the brain which creates disgust, is asking, oh, does that look good or look bad? And the orbital frontal is piping in, well, what's the societally acceptable thing to do? And the striatum is suggesting, well, what did I do yesterday? I want to do the same thing today. And the ventral media is weighing what's the best thing to do for us in the long term, and et cetera. And now, once a decision comes up, then there's a part of the brain called Broca's region, which has also the frontal and medial gyrus, yes. And those add language. And this is where the miracle really happens, because once it gets put into language, it all seems like these ideas and urges came from one place. But it didn't. It came from many, many different regions of the mind, some of which are firing, some of which are sitting that round of poker out. Everything you decide and do is the result of many, many different sub-regions firing, then higher regions arguing it out and deciding, and then it being all put into language afterwards to make it seem like you came up with the idea. The way neuroscientists describe it, they use a neat analogy which I like. They call it the monkey riding on the back of the elephant. The elephant being our impulses that are largely unconscious, which are racing around, and the monkey is on the back of the elephant explaining why it decided to turn left or right. It's the elephant coming up with the ideas. The monkey is just narrating it and making itself believe that it made all the decisions. Now, a very, very great neurobiologist named Benjamin Libet, who wrote a book called Mind Time, did a series of experiments where he discovered that the only role that consciousness plays is not coming up with ideas, but is overriding them or vetoing them if we come up with a really bad idea that can cause us real damage. In the scheme of things, our urges and ideas start well before our conscious mind. The frontal higher regions only have a last moment opportunity to stop us before we do something that's really harmful. You might say, well, where do we have even these capabilities of love or things that don't seem to be in our imminent survival best interests? And these ideas come from observing others, and they're registered as well in some of the regions of the brain, called the striatum, for example. But these observations are really, 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 really important. Before I explain why, I'd like to point out that the Buddha, 2,500 years ago in the Samyutta Nikaya and in other parts of the Pali Canon, said the exact same thing. He said what happens before we gain consciousness of any, make a decision, there's unconscious contact, whereupon we then have largely, barely witnessed underlying urges in the form of vedana, wanting, diswanting, that become more and more conscious with the frontal lobe and then turn into desire, then turn into attachment. He also said that the brain is the result of five components, which he broke down into things like thought, feelings or gut feelings and urges, perceptions, consciousness of the senses, consciousness of the body. And the Buddha was revolutionary with this. No other spiritual teacher believed such a thing that there was no soul or self. The Buddha got there. He observed the mind and he said, you know what? There is no lasting thinker in there. It's all just a conglomerate. It's a committee arguing. That's what we've got going on. Now, why is this important? So many reasons, but I'll just go over a few reasons why this should be of importance to you. The first reason is, think about how many times in your life you've gotten pissed off or irritated because somebody has acted inconsistently. Maybe you've never been angry at somebody because they've acted inconsistently. But most of us, one of the things that really gets our goat is when somebody says they're going to do one thing and they do another, or they act one way and then they act another, or they're generally one way, but then sometimes they're another way. It's called, we sometimes call the hypocrisy, whatever. This is not because there's something completely wrong with them. This is the nature of the human mind. The human mind is not a single consistent entity. It's a little warring committee. Just like you've had your days when you act out of anger, some days you act really refined, some days you act really generous, then other days you're really worried about money. No, you can't have any of mine. Other days you're like, oh my God, today I was so generous. I gave away my second skateboard, or I did something really nice, or today it was really weird. I was so angry. None of this is weird. None of this is strange or bizarre. This is the way the human mind works. Any appearance of consistency is only the result of people spending enormous amount of time and practice and energy practicing learning a new way to relate to their impulses so that they don't have to act out from them. But the normal human mind that is untrained without any spiritual practice will be an inconsistent mind that is acting out from multiple sources. The sources of the mind that are responsible for craving, the sources in the mind that are responsible for fear, the parts of the mind that are responsible for craving survival at all costs. There's many, many different subsections going on in there. And they're all vying for the light of day, for us to listen to them. And that's why people appear so inconsistent. Because the human mind is. Now, another important observation. No matter how much you try, you can't be an inner tyrant and shout down your fear, your anxiety, your addictions, and make them just go away. It doesn't work that way. Fear, anxiety, desires, all those things are always going to be there. They might always even be your first thought in certain situations. The good news is that there are ways of relating to them that don't require us to act out if they're bad ideas. But the normal way that humans relate to their anxieties or fears is we try to make them go away. We try to run from them. We try to yell at them. We feel ashamed by them. And that doesn't work because they're all parts of the human mind that are there for a reason. Fear is there to ensure our survival. Anger is there to ensure that we don't get mistreated again. It's all there. All those subsystems have survival reasons for them. A lot of the survival reasons have become are no longer necessary. The human mind is way out of date and acts like our survival is constantly a threat when it's not. That's because the brain was pretty much locked into shape 50,000 years ago when the Earth was a really fucked up place. We haven't evolved, the brain hasn't evolved since then. So we're still pretty much in this very, very fear-driven and anxious mind. The trouble also is that these older parts of the brain responsible for fear and anger and desire, craving, they are all very powerful. They're all very powerful. They all have a lot of neurotransmitters at their disposal, and they've also got the body at their disposal. They can talk to the body before we're even aware of it and get us stressed out as a way of getting their way. Think of it like a government with the lower houses rallying up the people, getting them all riled up, and then you've got the upper regions of the government maybe looking over and going, oh my God, we have to act because the Tea Party has got everybody riled up. So, the Buddha came up with a different way of relating to our impulses and urges. Rather than shaming or getting bent out of shape or freaking out, the Buddha came up with, I'm going to read you one of my favorite, very short teachings by the Buddha that I think summarizes one of his great revolutionary insights as a result of knowing how the brain works, the mind works. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, number 11. The Buddha is going to be talking about a god at that time called Sakka, who was a very benevolent god. And all the people then at the time knew of Sakka. So he's using this story as a teaching, as a lesson. So the Buddha, I'm just going to read you it in its entirety. On a certain occasion, the Buddha was dwelling at the Jetavana monastery, and there he addressed all of those in attendance. Monks, says the Buddha, once upon a time Sakka, the divine god of all gods, was traveling through the cosmos. I gather Sakka was on vacation. And he was absent from his throne. And in Sakka's absence, a sickly-looking, sneaky little demon seated himself on the empty throne, on Sakka's empty throne, hoping that Sakka's attendance would bring him some good food. I guess the demon thought, well, they'll mistake me for Sakka, and these attendants will give me all this wonderful food that the gods get. So the attendants come in, and seeing this ugly little demon on the throne, they shouted, "You ugly demon, how dare you sit on the throne of Sakka? Go away!" Now, as the gods and attendants hurled their outrage and insults, the demon, this little demon, fed on their anger and grew larger and stronger and more ferocious. And soon the little demon became terrifyingly large and powerful, and the attendants cowered before this huge, frightening, fire-breathing demon that had just a few moments ago, before it was greeted with anger and disgust, was a tiny little demon. When Sakka returned, he saw the futility of his attendants' outrage and hostility, and instead he politely approached the huge demon, saying, "Welcome, my friend. Hello. Stay seated. I can take another chair. May I offer you a drink of hospitality?" And with this kindness, the demon shrunk until it disappeared from sight. Now, there's a reason why the Buddha is telling this story. And it's not just because he likes telling stories about demons. The point is he's talking about how do we relate to all of our anger and our fear and our sense of outrage and our sense of injustice and our sense that we've been mistreated and our nagging impulses that always feed on our sense of, oh my God, I can't believe I still feel this way, or I can't believe this has happened. And we throw more and more resistance and more go away at our weaknesses. And they, in turn, feed off of all this hostility and resistance and become larger and larger and larger until we're at war with ourselves. And then we really see how the mind is not a coherent thing, but actually it's at war with itself. Its different parts are battling it out. For instance, when we might want to quit our jobs because we hate it, and then the next thought is, but oh my fucking God, I'll starve, I won't be able to pay the rent. So fear is at war with our desire. So, instead, the Buddha suggests saying hello, finding a comfortable spot, as Sakya did, bringing up a chair and getting comfortable, noticing the underlying urges, and just allowing them, being patient, being not judging, and just allowing this process to pass rather than feeding it by resistance, is one of the most powerful tools. There's other powerful tools the Buddha offered, finding the area in the body that gets tense when anger and fear arise, and then instead of pushing away our fear or anger, simply going into the body and breathing into whatever area gets tight. Another technique that's often taught is using these urges constructively, giving them an outlet that's useful rather than self-sabotaging. For example, we all have a part in our minds that's very judgmental. We all don't want to be judgmental at all. We all like to think, I don't like other people who are judgmental, but I'm not judgmental, but in fact we are all judgmental. So rather than deny that we have any judgmental part of the brain, because you do, so get used to it, instead let's use it in a constructive way. Focus on whatever it is we're pinning our minds on and ask ourselves, is this really bringing peace into my life? The Buddha called this Dhamma Vikaya, judging whether the way we're using our minds is bringing us peace right now. That's a skillful use of judgment. Fear. Fear is often misused in that it fixates on the unknowable future. We fear what might happen to us tomorrow or later on, or the results of actions that are unseeable. The Buddha said one of the ways to go insane is to try to work out what's going to happen in the future, the way karma will play out. But there is a skillful use of fear. We can fear as we're about to take an action, an impulse, we can fear doing something that will cause harm to ourselves or others. The Buddha called this Samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A. It means the skillful use of fear. Rather than fearing the unknowable, fear like, oh my God, this thing that I'm really, really being driven to do, am I really sure that it's going to bring peace into my life? Is it, have I seen this action or this thing I'm about to say? Have I seen it bring lasting skillfulness? Finally, another example is hypervigilance, that part of the brain that feels, unless we're constantly monitoring everything that's going on with everybody, does this person like me? Does that person like me? Are they judging me? Are you looking at me weird? What are you thinking about me? That's hypervigilance, by the way. So, rather than allowing this to be focused on trying to read other people's minds, which, guess what, it turns out you can't do. If it was possible, the Buddha would have been able to do it, but you can't read other people's minds. So, instead, use hypervigilance to read your own mind. Notice what's going on beneath the surface. When we feel a real impulse, before we do it, notice what's going on. Is there stress forcing me? Is the mind getting contracted? Are the thoughts yelling at me? Am I shouting at myself? Am I speaking to myself with my thoughts in a kind way? Am I allowing my thoughts to speak to me the way I would expect a friend to speak with me? Or am I treating myself like an enemy by shouting and yelling at myself? This is vigilance, as the Buddha said, is necessary, appropriate attention, but it's not going again towards the unknowable. It's going to what is knowable, what's going on right now in my mind. So the general idea is when impulses come up, rather than start a war with them, first note them, say hello, hello fear, hello anger, hello doubt, hello worry, and then rather than allow them to fixate, if they really want to fixate on something that's unknowable, see if you can channel them to something, a use that's really, really skillful, happening right here, right now, so that we can use all these parts of the brain, all the members of the committee, in a skillful way, rather than allow our minds to get bent out of shape about stuff that there is no possible answer to. There is no way we can know what will happen tomorrow in the future. So allowing your mind to go there and worry it and try to figure it all out is a waste of an incredible machine you have at your disposal, your own mind. So that's tonight's talk. I hope you got something out of it. Hope it sparked something of insight or wisdom.